soon to burn. All day he was light-hearted and high-spirited, as though at last he had found a way out of the frightful difficulty. The next morning, we found him dead in his bed. A peaceful smile upon his careworn face. Asphyxiation. Through the connivance of the police and the authorities, it was given out to the world as heart disease. We deemed it wise to withhold the truth. But little good has it done us. Little good has anything done us. Barely had I left that chamber of death when, but too late, the following letter was received.
Office of the MFM, February 17, 1900. Mr. Eben Hale, Money Baron. Dear Sir, you will pardon our intrusion, we hope, so closely upon the sad event of day before yesterday. But what we wish to say may be of the utmost importance to you. It is in our mind that you may attempt to escape us. There is but one way, apparently, as you have ere this doubtless discovered. But we wish to inform you that even this one way is barred. You may die, but you die failing and acknowledging your failure. Note this, we are part and parcel of your possessions. With your millions, we pass down to your heirs and assigns forever. We are the inevitable. We are the culmination of industrial and social wrong. We turn upon the society that has created us. We are the successful failures of the age, the scourges of a degraded civilization. We are the creatures of a perverse social selection. We meet force with force. Only the strong shall endure. We believe in the survival of the fittest. You have crushed your wage slaves into the dirt, and you have survived. The captains of war, at your command, have shot down like dogs your employees in a score of bloody strikes. By such means you have endured. We do not grumble at the result, for we acknowledge and have our being in the same natural law. And now the question has arisen. Under the present social environment, which of us shall survive? We believe we are the fittest. You believe you are the fittest. We leave the eventuality to time and law. Cordially yours, the Minions of Midas.
John, do you wonder now that I shunned pleasure and avoided friends? But why explain? Surely this narrative will make everything clear. 3 weeks ago, Adelaide Laidlaw died. Since then, I have waited in hope and fear. Yesterday, the will was probated and made public. Today, I was notified that a woman of the middle class would be killed in Golden Gate Park in faraway San Francisco. The dispatches in tonight's papers give the details of the brutal happening, details which correspond. Those furnished me in advance. It is useless. I cannot struggle against the inevitable. I have been faithful to Mr. Hale and have worked hard. Why my faithfulness should have been thus rewarded, I cannot understand. But I cannot but fall to my trust nor break my word by compromising. Still, I have resolved that no more deaths shall be upon my head. I have willed the many millions I lately received to their rightful owners. Let the stalwart sons of Eben Hale work out their own salvation. A, read this. I should have passed on. The Minions of Midas are all powerful. The police are impotent. I have learned from them that other millionaires have been likewise mulcted or persecuted. How many is not known. For when one yields to the M of M, his mouth is thenceforth sealed. Those who have not yielded are even now reaping their scarlet harvest. The grim game is being played out. The federal government can do nothing. I also understand that similar branch organizations have made their appearance in Europe. Society is shaken to its foundations. Principalities and powers are as brands ripe for the burning. Instead of the masses against the classes, it is a class against the class. We, the guardians of human progress, are being singled out and struck down. Law and order have failed. The officials have begged me to keep this secret. I have done so, but can do so no longer. It has become a question of public import, fraught with the direst consequences, and I shall do my duty before I leave this world by informing you of its peril. Do you, John, as my last request, make this public. Do not be frightened. The fate of humanity rests in your hand. Let the press strike off millions of copies. Let the electric current sweep it round the world. Wherever men can meet and speak, let them speak of it in fear and tremble. And then, when thoroughly aroused, let society arise in its might and cast out this abomination. Yours, a long farewell. Wade, Ashton. Jack London. Wade Atchley is dead. Dead by his own hand. To say that this was entirely unexpected by the small coterie which knew him would be to say an untruth. And yet, never once had we, his intimates, ever canvassed the idea. Rather had we been prepared for it in some incomprehensible subconscious way. Before the perpetration of the deed, its possibility was remotest from our thoughts. But when we did know that he was dead, it seemed somehow that we had understood and looked forward to it all the time. This, by retrospective analysis, we could easily explain by the fact of his great trouble. I use great trouble advisedly. Young, handsome, with an assured position as the right-hand man of Eben Hale, the great street railway magnate, there could be no reason for him to complain of fortune's favors. Yet we had watched his smooth brow furrow and corrugate, as under some carking care or devouring sorrow. We had watched his thick black hair thin and silver, green grain under brazen skies and parching drought. Who can forget in the midst of the hilarious scenes he toward the last sought with greater and greater avidity? Who can forget, I say, the deep abstractions and black moods into which he fell? At such times when the fun rippled and soared from height to height, suddenly, without rhyme, reason, his eyes would turn lackluster. His brows knit, as with clenched hands and face overshot with spasms of mental pain, he wrestled on the edge of the abyss with some unknown thing. He never spoke of his trouble,
nor were we indiscreet enough to ask. But it was just as well, for had we, and had he spoken, our health and strength would have availed nothing. When Eben Hale died, whose confidential secretary he was, nay, well-nigh adopted son and full business partner, he no longer came among us. Not, as I now know, that our company was distasteful to him, but because his trouble had so grown that he could not respond to our happiness, nor find surcease with us. Why this should be so, we could not at the time understand. For when Eben Hale's will was probated, the world learned that he was sole heir to his employer's many millions, and it was expressly stipulated that this great inheritance was given to him without qualification, hitch, or hindrance in the exercises thereof. Not a share of stock, not a penny of cash, was bequeathed to the dead man's relatives. As for his direct family, one astounding clause expressly stated that Wade Atcher was to dispense to Eben Hale's wife and sons and daughters whatever monies his judgment dictated at whatever times he deemed advisable. Had there been any scandal in the dead man's family, or had his sons been wild or undutiful, then there might have been a glimmering of reason in this unusual action. But Eben Hale's domestic happiness had been proverbial in the community, and one would have to travel far and wide to discover a cleaner, saner, wholesomer progeny of sons and daughters. While his wife, well, by those who knew her best, she was endearingly termed the mother of Gracchi. Needless to state, this inexplicable will was a 9 days wonder. But the expectant public was disappointed in that no contest was made. It was only the other day that Eben Hale was laid away in his stately marble mausoleum. And now, Wade Atchula is dead. The news was printed in this morning's paper. I have just received through the mail a letter from him, posted, evidently, but a short hour before he hurled himself into eternity. This letter, which lies before me, is a narrative in his own handwriting, linking together numerous newspaper clippings and facsimiles of letters. The original correspondence, he has told me, is in the hands of the police. He has begged me also, as a warning to society, against a most frightful and diabolical danger which threatens its very existence, to make public a terrible series of tragedies in which he has been innocently concerned.
It was in August 1899,
just after my return from my summer vacation.
But the blow fell. We did not know it at the time. We had not yet learned to school our minds to such awful possibilities.
Mr. Hale opened the letter, read it, tossed it upon my desk with a laugh.
When I had looked it over, I also laughed, saying, "Some ghastly joke, Mr. Hale.
Exact duplicate of the letter in question."
Office of the M of M, August 17, 1899. Mr. Eben Hale, Money Bearer. Dear Sir, we desire you to realize upon whatever portion of your vast holdings is necessary to obtain in cash 20 millions of dollars. This sum we require you to pay over to us or to our agents. You will note we do
cannot specify any given time, for it is not always the hurry this man. You may even, if it be easier for you, pay us in 10, 15, or 20 installments. But we will accept no single installment of less than a million. Believe us, dear friend, when we say that we embark upon this course of action utterly devoid of animus. We are members of that intellectual proletariat, the increasing numbers of which mark in red lettering the last days of the 19th century. We have, from a thorough study of economics, decided to enter upon this business. It has many merits, chief among which may be noted that we can indulge in large and lucrative operations without capital. So far, we have been fairly successful, and we hope our dealings with you may be pleasant and satisfactory. Pray attend while we explain our views more fully. At the base of the present system of society is to be found the property right. And this right of the individual to hold property is demonstrated in the analysis to rest solely and wholly upon might. The male gentlemen of William the Conqueror divided and apportioned England amongst themselves with a naked sword. This, we are sure you will grant, is true of all feudal possessions. With the invention of steam and the Industrial Revolution, there came into existence the capitalist class, in the modern sense of the word. These capitalists quickly towered above the ancient nobility. The captains of industry have virtually dispossessed the descendants of the captains of war. Mind and not muscle wins in today's struggle for existence. But this state of affairs is, nonetheless, based upon might. The change has been qualitative. The old-time feudal baronage ravaged the world with fire and sword. The modern money baronage exploits the world by mastering and applying the world's economic forces. Brain and not brawn endures. And those best fitted to survive are the intellectually and commercially powerful. We, the M of M, are not content to become wage slaves. The great trusts and business combinations with which you have your rating prevent us from rising to the place among you which our intellects qualify us to occupy. Why? Because we are without capital. We are of the unwashed. But with this difference, our brains are of the best, and we have no foolish ethical nor social scruples. As wage slaves, toiling early and late and living abstemiously, we could not save in 80 years, nor in 80 times 80 years, a sum of money sufficient successfully of massed capital. Nevertheless, we have entered the arena. We now throw down the gauge to the capital of the world. Whether it wishes to fight or not, it shall fight. Mr. Hale, our interests dictate us to demand a new $20 million. While we are considerate enough to give you reasonable time in which to carry out your share of the transaction, please do not delay too long. When you have agreed to our terms, insert a small piece in the animal of the Morning Blazer. We shall then acquaint you with our plan for transferring the sum mentioned. You had better do this sometime prior to October 1st. If you do not, in order to show that we are in earnest, we shall on that date kill a man on East 39th Street. He will be a working man. This man you do not know, nor do we.
You represent a force in modern society. We also represent a force, a new force. Without our personal malice, we have closed a battle. As you will readily discern, we are simply a business proposition. You are the upper, and we the nether, millstone. This man's life shall be ground out between you. You may save him if you agree to our conditions and act in time. There was once a king cursed with a golden touch. His name was taken to do duty as our official seal. Some came to protect ourselves against competitors. We shall copy it. We beg to remain the minions of points.
I leave it to you, dear John. Why should we not have laughed over such a preposterous communication? The idea we could not be planned as well conceived, but it was too grotesque to be taken seriously. Mr. Hale said he would preserve it as a literary curiosity and shoved it away in a pigeonhole. Then we promptly forgot its existence. And his promptly, on the 1st of October, going over the morning mail, we read the following. Office of the MLM, October 1899. Mr. Dear sir, your victim has met his fate. An hour ago, on East 39th Street, a working man was thrust through the heart with a knife. Ere you read this, his body will be lying at the morgue. Go and look upon him. On October 14th,
society is indeed unstable when the custodians of its peace are thus openly and wantonly shot at. The police have so far been unable to obtain the slightest clue. Barely had he finished this when the police arrived. The inspector himself took two of his keenest smooths. Alarm set upon their faces, and it was plain that they were seriously perturbed. Though the facts were so few and simple, we talked long, going over the affair again and again. When the inspector went away, he confidently assured us everything would soon be straightened out and the assassin brought to Earth. In the meantime, he thought it well to leave Hale down for the protection of Mr. Hale and myself, and several more to be constantly on the vigil about the house and grounds. After the lapse of a week, at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, this telegram was received.
I had one bad experience in America, but I had a great many good experiences in America. I've lectured in a very great many American universities, and in some of them I've had very, very good pupils and had a really, very good time indeed. I had just one bad experience in the college in the city of New York, where it was decided that I was an immoral influence and that I must not be allowed a position in such an institution. I'd written a book called Marriage and Morals, in which I educated a certain very moderate degree of freedom, such as I think most civilized people would agree to. But in New York that were not very civilized, they didn't like it. Well, it started with Bishop Manning denouncing me. And then the Catholic Church took it up. And professors and such defended me, but they weren't, they didn't count. They got a woman who was a Roman Catholic and whose daughter had been going to go to the College City of New York to bring a suit against the City of New York on the ground that her daughter would be exposed to immoral influences if I were allowed to teach there. And the City of New York was quite different from the college. The college had wanted me, but the city as such did not. And it was the city that had defended this case, and it defended it with a view to losing it. And so it did lose it. I was teaching philosophy, but it was thought they didn't know what philosophy was. And they thought anything I don't know must be bad. And probably philosophy teaches this sort of scandalous conduct. As a matter of fact, I wasn't even going to teach philosophy, I was going to teach mathematical logic. But they couldn't bother with that.
In the indictment was an epithet, cherished today in recollection by Lord Russell, which was introduced by a lawyer with more zeal than literacy.
New literacy, mischievous, obscene, and aphrodisiac. I had lots of fun. I was lecturing at Los Angeles, University of California. And I began one of my lectures. I was lecturing on history of philosophy, and I'd been talking about Plato. And I got up very solemnly and said, I owe my class an apology. I have recommended to you, not done unfavorably, an author who, I regret to say, was new, lecherous, lascivious, and obscene. I mean Plato. Because the things that Plato says about marriage and so on are quite as bad as anything I've ever seen. I said that one shouldn't be too hard on adultery, that I thought a husband or wife in an otherwise happy marriage would be able to forgive an occasional infidelity. I said also that I thought some premarital experience was desirable. It's a thing that all expert moralists, that's the only people who really take a lot of fuss about morals, quite obsessed by sex. I got a letter from an Anglican bishop, now dead, saying that every word in all my books was inspired by sexual lust. And he didn't know that I'd written on other subjects than sex, because sex was the only thing that interested him.
He was in the trance one day, and Woody admitted that there was any connection between Christ and the Lord. It's better.
They had much to do with Christ. Now, Christ made two trances on the divorce. One of them blesses and the other unblesses. So the church chose the unblesses one and ignored the other. In one pronouncement, he says that there must be no divorce. In another, he says that there must be no divorce except for adultery. But the one where he says that there should be no except for adultery is completely ignored by the church. They just tell it isn't there. Because it doesn't cause so much pain. I don't object to tradition as such. I object to the Catholic tradition.
It was a Catholic who gave me so much trouble.
Yeah.
Got a timetable? Well, get on it. It's your time.
Side. Whereas in those days, if you went outside marriage, it could only be for the most intense and profound and lifelong passion. Nothing else would excuse it.
Thank you. sadness, all these things will be felt. And suddenly you will become aware that sadness is there like an object. And you are watching and witnessing. And suddenly you start feeling happy. Such a beautiful sadness, a flower of darkness. A flower of eternal death. Like an abyss without any bottom. And so silent. So musical. No noise at all. No disturbance. One can go on falling and falling into it. Endlessly. And one can come out of it absolutely rejuvenated. It is a rest. It depends on the attitude. When you become sad, you think something bad has happened to you. This is an interpretation. That something bad has happened to you. And then you start trying to escape from it. You never meditate on it. Then you want to go to somebody and to a party and to the club or put the TV on or radio or start reading the newspaper. Do something so that you can forget. This is a wrong attitude that has been given to you, that sadness is wrong. Nothing is wrong in it. It is another polarity of life. Happiness is one pole, sadness is another. Blissfulness is one pole, misery is another. And life consists of both. And life is richer because of both. A life only of blissfulness will have extension, but will not have death. A life of only sadness will have death, but will not have extension. A life of both sadness and blissfulness.
Thank you.